Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Mitchell First, who is the author of his first book was Jewish History in Conflict, published by Aronson. And the newer book as well is called, one we'll be discussing really, is Esther Unmasked, which is the subtitle, Solving 11 Mysteries of the Jewish Holidays and Liturgy. And we're mainly going to be discussing the articles in here that are focused on Achashverosh, Esther, Tainus Esther, and Purim-related subjects. So thank you very much, Mr. First, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, why don't we start off, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I grew up in Riverdale. I went to SAR, and then I went to Ramaz for high school. From Ramaz, the goal was not to go to Yeshiva University, but the goal was for you to go to Columbia, nor were they sending people to learn in Yeshiva in Israel for a year. This was in 1975. So basically, I followed with the program. I went from Ramaz directly to Columbia College, and then I continued there into Columbia Law School. But eventually, I was able to go to Israel for Yeshiva, and I started at Rabbi Bravender's Yeshiva. And there I got interested in ancient Jewish history. So then when I came back from Israel, I decided to work with I'm a lawyer. I decided to work with my father, who was a lawyer. And that way I would be able to get a master's degree from Revel in the evening. So that worked out well. I studied a lot with Dr. Lyman and with Dr. Lewis Feldman. My master's was written under Dr. Lyman about Seder Olam's too short chronology of the Persian period. That eventually became my first book, Jewish History in Conflict, which was the main selection in the Jewish Book Club in the month of August of 1997. It was published by Jason Aronson. Of course, today there's no longer a Jewish book club. And if Jason Aronson exists, they're not doing Jewish books. I'm not even sure exactly what they really do now. Okay, over the years, I wrote a lot of articles for Hakira and for Sfarim Blog. And eventually I put them together and that became my Esther Unmasked book, which had 11 articles on all the holidays. Now, the past 7 years, I've been writing for the Jewish Link, which is a paper that started out covering a small part of New Jersey, but keeps expanding. Now it covers a large part of New Jersey, plus New York and Connecticut as well. I put 62 weekly columns together, and that became my book, Roots and Rituals, in 2018. My articles, I generally write about Hebrew words, or about Jewish history, about liturgy. And another book is coming out soon, Links to Our Legacy, which is the same idea. I collect columns, I improve my columns a little bit. So I collect columns and turn them into books. Also, you know, I have a story I'll tell you at the end, but I was greatly influenced by Shadal. And again, I'll get back to that at the end. And I also have a website, rootsandrituals.org, which lists 80 of my articles.
Okay, so your book, as I mentioned, Esther Unmasked, is also a collection of articles that you've written. And now, like I said, there are the main ones that we're going to focus on, even the title suggests it's John Achashverosh, Esther, Purim-related things. But I think just first mention a little bit, just quickly, you know, briefly for listeners, you know, what are the rest of the book is about?
Sure. I just want to add also, you know, the Esther Unmasked book is 11 serious long articles, unlike what I write in the weekly columns, which is all much shorter. So the Esther Unmasked, you know, is in more of an advanced book. Okay, so let me just give you some examples of what's in Esther Unmasked. So one article is, what is the meaning of Maccabee? Another is, what is the meaning of Hashmonai? What motivated Antiochus to issue his decrees? There's another article about the Manishtana. You know, Manishtana, the three questions. I mean, I think most of you hopefully know already that, you know, there are really only three questions in the Manishtana. You know, the printed Yerushalmi has three questions. And when you investigate the Girsa in the Bavli Mishnah, it's also only three. So the true Girsa in the Mishnah in Pesachim is three questions. So both Mesubin and Maror are later questions. So I have a whole article on that. Another article on Arami Oved Avi. Then I have another article on the Pei-Ayin order in ancient Israel and its implications for the Book of Tehillim. I'm hoping to come back again to do another podcast on that one in the summer. You know, that article is related to the book of Eicha. The Book of Eicha has in chapters 2, 3, and 4, the Pei is before the Ayin in all the acrostics in chapters 2, 3, and 4, and actually in the Dead Sea Scrolls, even in chapter 1. So the original order of the alphabet was really Pei before Ayin. This has ramifications for the Book of Tehillim, but that's, you know, this is an entirely a different podcast. Finally, the last article, I want to mention my Elena article. There I wrote an article how the real Girsa in Elena is Litaken along with a kaf, not a kuf, to establish a world. And, you know, how do you get this? It's based on Rav Sadia, the Rambam, Karo Gniza. So I had an article published in Chakira on this. There I only had four Gniza fragments, aside from the Rambam and Rav Sadia. But then I revised the article. I did more research and I got it, you know, on Svarim Blog, which has many more Gniza fragments. So then I took the Svarim Blog article and, you know, fixed it a little bit and put it into Esther Unmasked. But so those are most of the articles in the Esther Unmasked book.
Okay, so like we said, we'll discuss really Achashverosh and Esther. So let's start with Achashverosh. I think there's, you know, always people somewhat maybe know Achashverosh. Who was he historically? They've heard this king, that one. How do we find out who he is? You know, all that. So you have a whole lengthy, as you said, a lengthy, lengthy article about this. So, you know, how did you identify him in secular sources? Who is he? And talk about that.
Okay, great. Okay, you know, I worked on this for many, many years. Okay. So, you know, everybody agrees that Koresh allowed the Jews to return. And around 20 years later, the Second Temple was built in the reign of Daryavesh. Everybody's going to agree with those principles. Koresh is the initial return. 20 years later is King Daryavesh, the temple is built. The question is, what happened between them? So that's where the whole problem arose, but we're going to solve all problems. Okay, so see, the Megillah tells a whole story about Achashverosh, but it leaves out one detail. What does it leave out? Achashverosh ben so-and-so. See, does not say who came before him, does not say who came after him. And this has confused everybody for 2,000 years. Just that, you know, all it needed was a little more clues, but it's not there. However, in the fourth chapter of Ezra now, we're talking about the book of Ezra now, Achashverosh is mentioned, and there it's in the context with other Persian kings. So that potentially is very helpful. But the problem is that this chapter is very unclear. So the Seder Olam Rabbah and the Talmud, they understood the chapter as teaching that Achashverosh reigned between Koresh and Daryavesh. Now, again, Achashverosh is mentioned in the fourth chapter of Ezra. There is a context. So the Gemara, and based on Seder Olam, they understand Koresh, Achashverosh, Daryavesh. And you can remind, in your brain, you could just remember CAD. That's the official rabbinic chronology. Koresh, Achashverosh, Daryavesh. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because it turns out that somebody else is really in between Koresh and Daryavesh. So we'll get to that. But that's the starting point, that, you know, Chazal put Achashverosh between Koresh and Daryavesh, but it turns out we're going to have to change things a little bit. Okay, so how do we figure all this out? So until the mid-19th century, we only knew about the Persian kings from Greek sources. Then the inscriptions located in the ancient Persian palaces were deciphered, and the Persian names of the kings came to light. It turns out that the Greek sources did not always accurately preserve the names of the Persian kings. With regard to the king the Greeks were calling Xerxes, the Persian name of this king was discovered to be Khashayarsha. And this is in cuneiform writing, okay? But that's the way that it sounded, Khashayarsha. But then, you know, this is the mid-19th century, they discover how to read the ancient Persian cuneiform. But around 50 years later, they discover documents in Egypt in Aramaic, you know, Aramaic letters look like our Hebrew letters. So this king, how was Khashayarsha's name written in Aramaic letters? Chet Shin Yud Reshin. So this shows that they were reading the cuneiform correctly. But the point is that Xerxes' name in Persian was Khashayarsha, which is, you know, it's 95% the same as the name in the Megillah, which is that the Megillah has an aleph in the front. You know, the reason the Greeks botched the name is because they did not have a letter for the shin sound. So, if a king's name is like Chet Shin Reshin and your language doesn't have a letter for the shin sound, by definition, you're going to botch his name. And why is there an ES at the end of Xerxes? Where did that come from? You know, in the Greek language, their names have to end in a certain form to fit into their grammar. So they have to make names end with ES or IS or ON. Like, why is Moshe called Moses? Because in the Greek language, they have to add an ES to his name, and that's how it's in the Septuagint, and that's how it came down into English. Why is Shlomo called Solomon? Because again, in Greek, they have to, and they need an ending like ON. So they have ways that they end the names, ES, IS, ON. So those are just things that they tack on to foreign names. Okay. So far we've just discussed the linguistic match. You know, his name is Khashayarsha, Chechen Yud Reshin, which is basically the same, you know, as the name in the Megillah. But now we have to, you know, and all the details the trivial details that I'm not explaining a role in the articles, but I'm just giving you the basic principles here. Okay. But now we have to look again at the fourth chapter of Ezra. So I know for all of you at home, I hope you could, I'll talk slow. I hope you could take out a book of Ezra and open up to the fourth chapter. And then you could take out a pencil because I'm going to ask you to make a parenthesis. Okay. So just, okay. So I'll talk slow, but that's what I'm hoping you can do so that you'll understand this forever. Because very few people understand this. Okay. So Ahasuerus is in the right place in the fourth chapter of Ezra, provided that you understand the chapter properly. Okay, so he is in the right place, but you know, you got to understand the chapter properly, because the chapter was written in a very confusing way. So if you look at verse 5, it's talking about complaints in the reigns of Koresh. It says, and they complained in the reign of Koresh Melch Paras Ve'ad Malchut Daryavesh. So it's a reference to complaints in the reign of Koresh Ve'ad Daryavesh, or Koresh Melch Paras Ve'ad Malchut Daryavesh. So what is that Va'ad teaching you? You see, if Koresh and Daryavesh were adjacent kings, it would say complaints in the reigns of Koresh vid Daryavesh. That Va'ad is teaching you somebody who's in the middle. Okay, so everybody's going to agree somebody's in the middle. So Chazal put Ahasuerus in the middle. But it turns out, we know from Herodotus and Greek historians, really the order of the Persian kings is Koresh Cambyses Daryavesh. So that's the one who's in the middle, Cambyses. Now, I can't tell you his name in Hebrew because he's not in Tanakh, although we actually do have his name in Hebrew, Kufnun Bet Vav Zion Yud. That's, I think, from documents in Aramaic from Egypt. But anyway, so the point is that the Koresh on Daryavesh is Koresh Cambyses Daryavesh. Then what happens in verse 6 and verses 7 to 23, the Tanakh goes on a digression. See, Tanakh does not have parentheses. Tanakh does not have footnotes. If Tanakh goes on a digression, it's going to confuse everyone. And that's what happened here. For 2,000 years, no one understood this, okay? Well, because there was a digression and there's no footnotes and there's no parentheses. So the first digression is one line about Ahasuerus. And the next digression is verses 7 to 23 about the later king Artaxerxes. And then in verse 24, it goes back to the main narrative. So if you have your pencil, if you have your book of Ezra there, you could put an open parenthesis before verse 6, and then you put your closed parentheses after verse 23. And that's the parenthetical digression that confused everyone for years and years. So I'm just going to read something that I wrote here, and then you'll understand it, because I just want to make sure I use the exact right words. The Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes material at verses 6 through 23 is only a digression. The author decided to supplement the main narrative about complaints regarding the Jews' building work in the reigns of Koresh through Daryavesh, with mention of similar complaints in the reigns of the two subsequent kings. Verse 24 and the continuation of chapter 5 return to the main narrative, the story of the rebuilding of the temple in the reign of Daryavesh. All right, so we have this digression where they go to two later kings, and then the last verse, 24, goes back to the main narrative in the reign of Daryavesh. Now, the proper understanding of these verses only became evident in modern times when the identification of Ahasuerus and Xerxes became clear on linguistic grounds. Okay, so, you know, there's a whole process to understand this chapter. It took a long time. First, they had to figure out that Ahasuerus is Xerxes, and then you look at these verses again and realize, oh, there's a digression here. Then only in verse 24 is the go back to the main narrative. You know, and the Dot Mikra understands all this, okay? So, that, you know, that's, you got to make sure to read the right books, but the Dot Mikra has it all right. Okay, so that's basically how to understand Ezra chapter 4. You know, again, I mean, I went through this fast, but I mean, if you listen to the tape, you read my article and you look it up, you'll understand it, okay? Digression, without parentheses, without footnotes, and that confused everyone. Okay, so, you know, if I had a blackboard here, I would put on one side of the blackboard, I would write X-E-R-X-E-X. Then on the other side, I would write A-C-H-A-S-H-V-E-R-O-S-H. And you'd think that these names are not at all the same king, right? I mean, that's basically, you know, anybody tells you Xerxes Ahasuerus, it sounds ridiculous, right? But really, now you know enough to understand this, because the Persian name was like Chet Shin Yud Reh Shin. So, and the name goes different ways in each language. In Hebrew, the Chet Shin Yud Reh Shin ended up, okay, so the Megillah has an Aleph in the front, and then we ended up with two Vavs, although sometimes Ahasuerus has only one Vav, one time it has no Vavs. But so the Chet Shin Yud Reh Shin, you know, went one way in the Megillah with, you know, the additional Alephs and the Vavs. Mm-hmm. And in the Greek, So again, the Greek didn't have, the name went a different way. The Greek didn't have a shin, did not have a shin. And that chet shin became their KS letter, which we write in English as X. Okay, so the chet shin, they have one letter which makes a KS sound, we write in English as X. So the chet shin became the X, and then they add the ES ending at the end. You know, I mean, I'm not explaining it all, but these are the basic principles. So the names end up looking totally different, but really they all come from a fundamental, you know, chasyarsha, which again went different ways in the two different languages. Okay, so Ahasuerus is not the king immediately before Dariavesh, you know, where Seder Olam and the Talmud place him, but he's the king immediately after Dariavesh. When he reigned, the second temple was already in existence. And you know, this is all in the Dot Mikra, you know, for anyone who reads Dot Mikra carefully, but this is all there. Okay. Now, in the early years of his reign, Xerxes was involved in a war with the Greeks, and he was out of Persia for a portion of this time. This helps explain why it took him so long from year 3 to year 7 to find a new queen. And it can be calculated that Esther was taken to Ahasuerus only a few months after his return, after his military defeat. Okay, now we have to discuss who was exiled in that famous verse, Asher Hagla. So if Mordechai was the one who was exiled and Galus Yehoyachin took place in 597 BCE, Mordechai would have been about 120 years old in the reign of Xerxes. So the easy solution is that Kish, the last name listed, is the one who was exiled. You know, verse 5 says Mordechai ben Ya'ar ben Shimi ben Kish. Verse 6 says Asher Hagla. So it's very easy to read verse 6 as talking about Kish. And again, this is, again, what I'm saying, all this is in the Dot Mikra. So, okay. So, all right, I think basically now actually, I think I'm ready to move on to Esther.
Very interesting. So now that we've discussed Ahasuerus, and I think we should make clear also in the book, this is really the second part of the article. It's quite lengthy. It's not two different ones. So now we're going to go straight into Esther, which is obviously tied to Ahasuerus. So, you know, the same question, you know, really, I guess you were talking about it already. It goes right in. Who is Esther?
Okay. I just have one more point about Ahasuerus and Xerxes. I just want to make clear also, you know, this, what I said before about Ahasuerus and Xerxes, you know, I wasn't saying anything new. Scholars have figured all this out long ago. But that does not mean that they believe the story, but 99% of them will agree that Xerxes is the king intended. Okay, but now we're going to take the next step and talk about Xerxes' wife. Okay, and this is where I think that I have made a major contribution. All right, the Megillah calls Esther Hamalka 17 times. Now, we have two main narrative sources about Xerxes. One is Herodotus writing about 450. You know, the Purim story was like in the 480s, 470s. So Herodotus is writing about 450, and Ctesias is writing around 400 BCE. Okay, so Herodotus, and 50 years later, Ctesias.
Right, I'm going to jump in for a second for people that may not understand. The years are counting downward. That's why they may think that's funny. You may want to clarify.
Yeah. Okay, so counting downward, right. And these are both the considered Greek historians, Herodotus and Ctesias. Okay. According to Herodotus, Xerxes' wife was named Amestris. Now, I'm spelling that in English, A-M-E-S-T-R-I-S. It's really, he's writing in Greek, but the Greek letters essentially match those English letters, so it's not an issue. So Herodotus gives her name as Amestris and says that she was the daughter of a military commander named Otanes, O-T-A-N-E-S. Now, of course, the Megillah says Esther, you know, Esther's father was Abihail. Now, Ctesias, who's writing 50 years later, he describes Amestris as having outlived Xerxes and having been active in royal affairs, even in the reign of the next king, Artaxerxes. Okay, so those are our main clues. Okay, the simplest approach is to equate Amestris with Esther. We do not have Persian sources for her name, but Herodotus generally does a good job of recording the names of major Persian figures. Since he records the name of Xerxes' wife as Amestris, we can be fairly confident that her Persian name was based around the consonants M, S, T, and R. And of course, that IS at the end is just a suffix added by the Greeks, as I discussed before, you know, in the case of the ES of Xerxes. So when you look at this name, MSTR, out of the numerous possible consonants, three consonants are the same as in the Hebrew, S, T, and R, and in the same order. The probability is overwhelming that this is not just coincidence. Now, Herodotus records the name of Amestra's father as Otanes, but Herodotus may simply have been wrong on this detail. You see, no one ever said, if Herodotus says something, it must be true. No one ever says anything like that, okay? You know, Herodotus is known as the father of history. He's also known as the father of the lie. But here he has no reason to lie. But basically, no one ever said Herodotus was infallible. That's like a joke for anybody to make such a claim. Herodotus never set foot in Persia. He's writing 20 years after Xerxes' reign. He's traveling around the Middle East. He never examined Persian governmental records. You know, I mean, if 40% of what he writes was accurate, that would be a tremendous accomplishment. So again, just because Herodotus says something, you don't have to believe it. You know, no one says he's 100% or anything close to that. Separate from that, it's interesting, the Megillah itself gives Esther two names. It says Esther and Hadassah. You know, Hadassah is presumably the Jewish name and Esther is presumably the Persian name. So maybe Otanes and Abichail, the same person with two different names. I mean, that's, you know, very reasonable. What is most interesting is that the name Abichail even means military commander, which is what Herodotus said this Otanes did with his life. He was a military commander. So the point is, look, we have a contradiction on the detail of the name of the father, but it's a kasha, but it's not a winning kasha. That's the point, okay? It's a kasha, but it's not a winning kasha. Okay, now, the main story that Herodotus tells about Amestris involves a cruel thing that she did, okay? She took revenge on another woman and, you know, whatever. I could not say it, but I'll say it because I'm going to tell you later. You don't have to believe any of it. Okay, so she orders somebody mutilated and her body parts thrown to the dogs. But these scholars today, they know not to believe the stories that Greek history writers write about Persian women. The Greeks and the Persians were enemies, but it's more than that. Most likely, these stories about Persian women are just there for entertainment value. Scholars today realize that they are more aptly characterized as literature rather than as history. And when the scholars say it's literature, that means it's essentially fiction. So again, when the Greek writers write about Persian women, the scholars today realize this is essentially fiction. So Herodotus has one bad story about Amestris. But Ctesias, writing 50 years later, he's got several. But Ctesias, in general, has almost zero credibility as a historian. Like Herodotus, you know, sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong. Ctesias, people don't believe a word he says anyway. So it's very easy to dismiss whatever is in Herodotus and Ctesias about Amestris. If secular historians can easily dismiss these bad stories, we can do that as well. Now, one other problem is that one gets the impression from Herodotus, that he thought that Amestris was Xerxes' queen even in the first 7 years of his reign, even though he doesn't say this explicitly, but you do get that impression that Herodotus thought Amestris was Xerxes' queen even in the initial 7 years. But even if this was his belief, it would be understandable that he might have had such a belief. According to the Megillah, Vashti was gone by the third year. Xerxes reigned 18 years after that. To Herodotus and his informants, Vashti may have been long forgotten. Given that it is clear that Ahasuerus is to be identified with Xerxes, there's a presumption that their queens are the same. Their names essentially match, STR and MSTR. The issue is not whether we have enough evidence to equate Esther with Amestris. Rather, the issue is whether or not we have sufficient evidence to rebut the presumption that the queens are the same. When you phrase the question this way, there's clearly insufficient evidence to rebut such a presumption. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the Dat Mikra. So the Dat Mikra to the Chamesh Megillot, they agree with everything I said about Ahasuerus being Xerxes. But when it comes to the queen, they have an intro in the Chamesh Megillot intro. The person who wrote the intro, he said, look, Amestris was the main queen and Esther was something less than that. All right, so this is what's in the Dat Mikra to Chamesh Megillot, that Amestris, from Herodotus, the main queen, and Esther was something less. But it's evident to me he didn't realize that the IS at the end of the name of Messrs was just a Greek add-on, and it's really STR versus MSTR, which is really close. And, you know, and his approach is ignoring the numerous 17 times she's called Esther Hamalka in the Megillah. So what's interesting is that in the Dottenbrecher to Treyasar, Volume 2, they have an appendix. And the Treyasar, Volume 2, Appendix, Page 3, they put down Esther equals Amestris, question mark, without any discussion. Okay, so again, what I'm saying here is, you know, it's in that, kind of implicit in that Dottenbrecher footnote, even though it's not really discussed. Okay. Now, I want to add that, in my opinion, most likely Amestris' Persian name did have that initial M, MSTR. That's more likely than saying that an M was added by the Greeks. You know, we can suggest that the M dropped during the course of the transmission to Hebrew. Names often change when going from one language to another. Or we can suggest that perhaps it was a purposeful change to have her name sound like Samach Tuf Resh, which means hidden. A main theme of the Megillah is the hidden hand of God. You know, many years ago, I gave this lecture at Drisha, you know, and Rachel Friedman was teaching there. You know, now she has her own institution, Lamdenu. But, you know, when Rachel heard me give the speech, she mentioned to me, she pointed out to me that in the book of Shoftim, we have the name Kushan Rishatayim. You see, which means doubly wicked, but his name was probably not that. It was probably something close to that. And then the Hebrew and the Tanakh kind of adjusted a little bit to make him Rishatayim, doubly wicked. So maybe something like that happened here. But, you know, you don't have to get too much hung up on this M. In other words, whether it's the M was there initially or added, whatever, we have STR. Basically, the STR is a match. That's an overwhelming match. And how you explain that, whether the M was there initially or it was added, whatever it is, that's just a trivial detail. The names essentially match. I bought a great book many years ago called Persia and the Bible by Edwin Yamauchi. His name is Yamauchi. This book has everything you need to know about Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes. That's why it's called Persia and the Bible, right? Because those are the five kings that are in the Bible. And it was this book that pointed out to me that Herodotus never went to Persia. And that's when I began to realize that we don't have to believe what Herodotus wrote about the name of Amestris' father. The only problem with this book by Yamauchi is that he did not realize that Amestris was Esther. He did not discuss that. He has a little chapter on the possibility of Amestris being Vashti, but otherwise this is a great book, even though he overlooked the Amestris being Esther. In the secular world, they're so prejudiced against the Book of Esther that they often just write that the story can't be true because Xerxes' queen was Amestris, not Esther. Obviously, they don't have the right attitude of looking at the names. You got to have the right attitude to come up with the correct conclusions. And half of the people who write about this don't even realize that the IS at the end of the name of Amestris is just an addition by the Greeks. All right. I just have a few more important points here. The main plot of the Megillah takes place in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, right, year 12. Herodotus' main concern was Xerxes' invasion of Greece, and this invasion ended in the 7th year. Herodotus writes almost nothing about events after the 7th year of Xerxes. When he does, it's only some brief tangential mention. Ctesias, writing 50 years later, he also writes only about the first 7 years. Then he skips to Xerxes' assassination in his 21st year. So we know practically nothing from the narratives by Greek historians of the events of Xerxes from year 8 to his assassination. So yes, it is true that the Purim story is not mentioned in these narrative sources, but nothing at all from year 8 to the end is mentioned in these sources. And we don't have narratives from the Persian historians. Okay, so again, I recommend to everyone that they have to read my detailed article in the Esther Unmasked book. By the way, you'll see there that I can even find evidence for Mordechai in Ctesias. Just to review, we see Ctesias is not going to be in Herodotus because Herodotus only focuses on the first 7 years of Xerxes' reign, and Mordechai only became, you know, the Mishneh Lamelech in the after the Purim story in years 12 to 13. By the way, if Amestris was Esther, then the next king, Artaxerxes, who empowered Ezra and later Nehemiah, would have been a Jew. But I'm not claiming that he had a bar mitzvah. Okay, do you have any questions? Nachi, do you want to ask any questions or?
No, I think it's all very interesting. Like you said, it's all in the book, and we have still more to talk about. But the book, by the way, I should point out, I forgot, it's Kodesh Press, and it's about $20 for the hardcover. It's around more than 200 pages. It's quite nice. Like really, like you're saying, everything's really there more in depth. I think you mentioned this earlier, right? But you discuss even more in depth that Avichael and the Otanis, I think that the military commander, how it's similar, right? You discuss, I think, I don't know, you mentioned that before, but you discuss that more in the book, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, obviously, the names are not the same, but the his profession, he is a military commander. So, and again, if Esther has the name Hadassah, then maybe he had two names. So, you know, but again, I don't even think you have to get to this. I mean, to me, who says you have to believe what Horowitz says? I mean, no one says everything he says is 100%. That's like a joke. If anybody would take that position, it's a joke to say Horowitz is infallible. I mean, that's it would be an insane position. I'm basically finished with this topic, and you know, I'm ready to move on to the next topic, which is a brief discussion of the origin of Tanis Esther.
Right, and I just want to point out right before that for the listeners that, you know, like you said already, this is one lengthy article. There's a lot more there than we discussed, and there's lengthy footnotes. But just to give them an overview, that's what it is. Okay, so now that we discussed Achashverosh and Esther, and like I mentioned, it's more in-depth in the book, the other article that we want to discuss, and it's something that's also very negeh, as they say, is that is Tanis Esther. So you discuss in there the origins of Tanis Esther, how it began, people began fasting, the whole story. So talk about your research and your article on Tanis Esther.
Okay, all right. So first I have to tell you like a little background here. You know, I did a ton of research on this topic. I was trying to submit the article to Hakira. So that was my goal, write this article for Hakira. And after I did all this work, they finally rejected the article. So I was crushed, okay? Because, you know, what do I do now, right? So I was walking with Ephraim Canifogel, and he had been a rabbi for many years. But this time he was no longer a rabbi, but I happened to be walking with him. And I said, Rabbi Canifogel, what should I do now? Where should I put this article? So he thought for 30 seconds and he said, AJS Review, that's where you should send it. So of course, I never heard of this journal, AJS Review, because it turns out it's a very prestigious journal. It's where academics write. So that's why I never heard of it. But anyway, you know, the end result is that they accepted it. So I have a 40-page article in AJS Review in 2010. And then I did a 10-page summary in the Esther Unmasked book. Okay, so you know, you have a choice of either the long version or the short version in the Esther Unmasked book. Okay, so basically, you know, when you talk about Tanis Esther, there's two different customs. There's the Palestinian custom and the Babylonian custom. The Palestinian custom is very easy. Basically, it's in Masechet Sofrim and a few sources from the Geniza. They did a Monday, Thursday, Monday, 3 days of fasting in Adar. We don't have any sources in the Gemara for this. You know, these are all post-Talmudic sources, but I mean, it's possible that this custom started in the Gemara, in the time of the Gemara, but we don't really know. But basically, you know, we have clear sources Monday, Thursday, Monday, even though there's slight contradictions between them as to the dates. But Esther fasted 3 days in Nisan, so we understand that this Monday, Thursday, Monday thing in Adar, you know, was based on Esther's 3 days of fasting, even though it's at a different season. But everybody understands, you know, this is what was going on in Palestine. But what I solved was a different custom, the origin of the Babylonian custom, the one-day fast on the 13th of Adar. Okay, so that's a completely separate issue. Where did that start? So first reference to fasting on the 13th of Adar is from the 800s in the writings of Rav Natronai Gaon. Now, of course, the 30th of Adar was originally Yom Nicanor. That was a day where fasting was prohibited, you know, but that was much, much earlier. You know, that became a Megillas Tanis holiday. But at a certain point, the Megillas Tanis holidays were no longer observed. So, you know, that's, you know, whether it's in the Tanaitic period or the Moraic period, I mean, at a certain point, Megillas Tanis holidays are no longer observed. So the question really is, how come all of a sudden a fast day was observed on the 13th of Adar in the 800s in Babylonia? Now, when anybody researches the origin of this fast on the 13th of Adar, a source that is always mentioned is the She'iltos of Rav Achai Gaon. Rav Achai lived in the 700s. But Professor Brody of Hebrew University pointed out that the relevant shilta here is mostly in Hebrew, not in Aramaic like the rest of the shiltos. So it's not a real shilta, and it's something that was written later. Okay, so that's the first step, to realize that this shilta that everybody's always quoting is in the wrong language, so it's really not a real shilta, but later. So again, how do we go from no fasting on the 30th of Adar to it being a fast day in the 800s in Babylonia? So basically, I figured out what the intermediate step was, and no one had ever figured this out before. It all has to do with a Mishnah in the first chapter of Megillah. The Mishnah refers to a day called Yom HaKnisa. It's evident from both the Mishnah and the Gemara that it refers to Mondays and Thursdays when the villagers would enter into the cities. But in the Gaonic period, some Gaonim gave an unusual interpretation of this Mishnah. Now they're going to give an interpretation that's different than the one of the Gemara. Some Gaonim said this Yom HaKnisa refers to a fast on the 13th of Adar, a day on which the Jews gathered to fast. Now, they had a certain polemical reason for giving this unusual interpretation of the Mishnah, and I figured out what it was. Once they gave this interpretation of the Mishnah, in effect, they created an ancient fast on the 13th of Adar, which people then began to observe. Now, the earliest sources for this 13th of Adar fast in Babylonia call it Tanis Purim, not Tanis Esther. This supports the idea that the origin of the fast on the 13th of Adar had nothing to do with the 3 days of fasting initiated by Esther. So far, I have not disclosed what the polemical reason was that led to this Gaonic interpretation. You can read the reason in the article, in the Esther and Mass book. And again, you have to buy the book anyway because of the lengthy article on Ahasuerus and Esther in secular sources. So now I'm ready. I'd like to talk a little bit about my Elena article, unless, Nachi, do you want to ask me anything about this?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to point out that you do mention, I believe, in the article, right, that there is even a Xaviad, maybe in Colombia, that does have this in the this Girsa in the Gemara itself. Is that true?
Which Girsa you mean? Which are we on now?
About it says over here that you wrote that it included Pirush of Acha Shloisha Asos Man Kehila Lakoli Shenemer Nikla Yehudim Ba'areim VeLeitzarich Lamichta
That's like a later, okay, nine, but that's just like a later addition to the Gemara. No, right. So
right. I'm just pointing out that. I'm just pointing out something interesting to the listeners that you point out that even is a caveat that has it. I mean, where you pointed out the Gaonim have this interpretation. Do you know where can people find this? Is it Tshuva of the Gaonim? Do you know where they can find it?
No, right. In other words, are we on now?
Yeah.
Right. Now, this basically, see what happened in this in Tanis Esther research is everybody was staring at the Shilta for years and years, okay? But they're staring at the wrong source. The real earliest source is in Midrash Tanchuma. It's a Gaonic tshuva that's found in Midrash Tanchuma. But no one is really analyzing it because they all thought the Shilta was earlier. You see, but once I realized based on Professor Brody's research that everybody was staring at the wrong source. Then I realized let's stare at the right source, which is this Gaonic Tshuva in Midrash Tanchuma. And then I was able to figure out what the polemical reason was, and it has to do with Pirkei Ban Baboy. But I don't want to get into this.
It's quite lengthy. And I also point out you mentioned that it is in AJS and in the book, and also I think there's a version of the article on Sfarim blog, right? That's what it says. It says here that that a summary.
Fine. If I said, So probably what I wrote, right? Probably what I took was I took the Sfarim blog article and changed a few words and put it in the book. That's right. So the book is just the same thing as the Sfarim blog article.
Right. And that's something we'll get to the Elena article in a minute to discuss Elena a little bit here at the end as we finish up. But you have written quite a bit on Sfarim blog for people, so that we should mention that as well. Okay, even though it's a little different, you wanted to mention your Elena article as well. So you can briefly mention that here as well as we, wrap things up.
So I just want to tell you the story of my Elena Letaken Olam article, because I think it's kind of interesting how this all worked out. So, I sit in shul, the person sitting right near me, his name is Yechiel Levy, and he had a Taimani background. So one day he brought in his Taimani sitter, and I looked at it, and it had Letaken with a cuff. So I thought that was very interesting. And then it reminded me that I remember that Rav Sadia also had that girsa, but somehow when I saw the girsa in Rav Sadia, it didn't really have the impact on me. But when I saw Yechiel's Taimani sitter, like maybe the print was big, whatever it is, I realized, oh my gosh, This is a different meaning. It means to establish, doesn't mean to fix. Okay, so you know, now that I have Rav Sadia and I have the Taimanim, what's the next step? I got to look at the Rambam. So when you go to the Rambam, well, did Rambam say daily Elena? No, he did not say daily Elena, but he did say Rosh Hashanah Elena. So you can look in the Mishnah Torah. He has, you know, there's a section where his Nusach HaTefillah is for the whole year. But what happens when you look in the standard Mishnah Torah? There's a v'chule there. In other words, the printers didn't print everything that they had, and they, you know, they got a little lazy, so they put v'chules in. So if you want to know what's in the standard Mishnah Torah, you can't tell. So all these years, you know, no one knew what, you know, what, no one really thought about this issue. Okay, so finally, you know, they put out the Siddur of Rav Sadia. It came out like in the 1940s, but no one knew that the Rambam actually also had this Girsa. But, you know, once I got motivated on this topic, I saw all these people, when they put out new Rambams now, the Rambam also had it with a kaf. So all the you know, the new Rambams based on manuscripts, that just like Rav Sadia, Rambam has it with a kaf. And again, you know, nobody realized this for hundreds of years because there was a v'chule there. So I found a few Geniza fragments, four Geniza fragments with a kaf, and I wrote it up in Hakira. But then I learned about the site Geniza.org. And there, you know, you could look up Geniza fragments, you know, from your own home. So I decided to get more ambitious, and I wrote to a certain professor in Israel, and he gave me a list of all the fragments from the Cairo Geniza, which had Aleinu. Now, fragments, by definition, it's fragment, it's ripped. So he gave me a list of 40 fragments, but that doesn't mean that they all had the phrase that I was interested in, L'tzaken Olam. But, you know, but about half of them did. So basically, you know, I started looking at these Geniza fragments, you know, on my computer from Geniza.org. And out of like, you know, 20 fragments from the Geniza, you know, 18 had it with a kuf, just like Rav Sadia and the Rambam. One had it with a kuf. And then there was one which had just like the horizontal bar on the top. And I couldn't tell whether it was a kuf or a kuf. But anyway, I approved the article, put it on Sforum blog, you know, so the Sforum blog article is the one which has the much more Geniza research. And, you know, that's the one that I put in the Esther and Mass book. Okay, I think I'm kind of finished with that, unless you want to ask me anything about that.
No, I think that's very interesting. Like you said, people can see it again on Sforum blog and in the book as well. So I think you did mention at the beginning that you were influenced by Shadal, and I did. Many listeners may be familiar. I had a podcast with Dan Klein. I think you're friends with on Shadal, and that was pretty popular. So maybe talk a little bit about Shadal, and you said you had a story to say as well.
Right. Okay. So, you know, in 1997, my first book was published by Jason Aronson. It was about the too short Persian period in Chazal, and I had been in Teaneck 10 years, and my charusa for all these 10 years was someone named Steve Leichman. Okay, so I've been in Teaneck, been learning with Steve Leichman for 10 years. And his wife was named Abby. And what was her maiden name? Klein. Okay, so one day in 1998, Abby says to me, "My brother is having his book published by Jason Aronson." And I said, "Well, what's it about?" And she said, "Shadal." At this point in my life, I had never heard of Shadal. But, you know, out of loyalty to my charusa and his wife, and to my publisher, I decided to buy this book, and it was really life-changing. This was Shadal on Genesis. You know, the wide variety of sources, you know, the analysis of roots. I mean, ever since then, much of my focus, you know, in my scholarship and writing has been on etymology, all because of Shadal. Now, I want to tell you, right, okay. So now, you know, both Daniel Klein and myself, now we both publish with Kodesh Press, since Jason Aronson no longer publishes Jewish books. Again, I don't know whether they exist in any event, but, and actually I was the one who referred Daniel Klein to Kodesh Press 6 years ago for his Exodus volume. You know, we both had the same problem that Jason Aronson, who published our original books, who are no longer publishing. And Daniel Klein, you know, he just did Leviticus, just came out too. And finally, just to end, it was Daniel Klein who was the one who told me about Sforum Chatter just a few weeks ago. Okay, so I'm basically done. I do want to share my email address if anyone has any questions. My email address is mfirst, that's, you know, mfirst@ATTY @AOL.com. I still use AOL. It helps me better understand, you know, the ancient world.
I guess. I mean, yeah, most people, right, the standard is like Gmail, but Absolutely. So thank you very much. I think one thing I think maybe I would ask you, are there any articles, any new things that you're, you know, you can tell, share with the listeners that you're working on currently at Olfra's Farm blog or any Hakira, any, anything currently you're working on?
No. So now I don't do the long serious articles anymore. Now I do the short, I do, you know, short humorous things, that short humorous pieces. So I just have, you know, I put columns every week. I'm many weeks ahead in my columns. But again, it's a different focus. Like you compare the Esther and Mass book to the Roots and Rituals book. Esther and Mass is 11 articles, footnotes, you know. And then when I write my columns in the newspaper, they have very little footnotes, and there's no footnotes in the newspaper. And then I put a few footnotes in the books, but the articles are all short and much more humorous. So different style.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So thank you very much. And I will put in link in the show's notes. I'll put your email address and people can contact you if they would like. And I will also put links to purchase the books. And like I said, you can be found on Svarim blog as well. Just put in your name on Svarim blog. They can search and find it there as well. And I would mention the one last thing is your original book, which I've heard good things about, which was from Aronson, Jewish History and Conflict. I'm not sure if it's available anywhere. And if it is, it's very expensive, I think.
No, right. So the answer is, I said Jason Aronson doesn't really publish books anymore, but Jewish books anymore, but they sold the rights to Roman and Littlefield. So you can, these books don't go out of print. They exist, but somehow Roman and Littlefield chart has a ridiculous price for the book. So you could always buy the book, but it's very expensive. And, but there's no such thing as going out of print. Like the technology, it changed. So the books are, maybe you don't have to get original, you don't get the original cover. You don't get the cover that Jason Aronson made, but the book itself does not go out of print.
Right. I think it's like $75.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Okay.